We then used work of a philosopher named Amy Gutman to argue that for a democratic threshold, that we should set the year 12 as a notion of a democratic threshold. And I'm aware that ETRF, that South Australia, that many states have moved down this road. But what's very interesting is that it's done often under the auspices of learner work, of human capital production, and basically solving the other problem, which is kids in the street, as against having any kind of explicit framing in terms of an egalitarian Australian society. So we provided our Dunstan and Bannon-esque colleagues in South Australia with the notion of that year 12 could be framed as a democratic threshold and also as a democratic entitlement. Okay, now that said, when we turn to the PISA data and McGaugh's and Margaret Vickers and Stephen Lamb's secondary analysis of the PISA data, we begin to find some very interesting results. First of all, we can map in a scatter plot on an XY coordinate, we can map achievement levels and the impact of social class, or not class, but they would call it socioeconomic background. And what we begin to find is that some systems, like the United States, has one of the steepest equity coefficients, which McGaugh argues the U.S. sits something like that. That is the impact of socioeconomic background on overall year 7 performance appears to be quite high. The flattest equity gradient on the McGaugh PISA data is that of Finland, where what that suggests is that your social background is less likely to impact upon your overall achievement. Another way of looking at the equity problem is the size of the standard deviation on the PISA achievement. And what we begin to find is standard deviation will indicate to you the spread of achievement. And what we begin to find is that in the case of Finland, Canada, Ireland, several other countries, the number of kids clustered at the top and clustered at the bottom actually is much smaller than it is in Australia. Is that, everybody got the basic argument? So although Australia scores reasonably well on PISA, 4 in the literacy area, and I think 14th in the TIMSS and PISA data on science, or 12th right in the middle of the pack. What we begin to see, so that will give you the mean of the norm. What we begin to see is that Australia's standard deviation is much larger than some of these high quality low equity countries. Okay, that is, we have a bigger bunch of kids at the bottom and a bigger bunch of kids at the top. And that seems to be between PISA 2003 and 2005. Is that it? 2000 and 2005. Between the two sampling periods, that standard deviation appears to have gotten larger. Now, whether we attribute that to any policy or anything like that, we don't know. But it appears that the number of kids in the top performing ranks is holding static, and the number of kids in the bottom performing ranks is actually increasing. Not on a very large basis, but on a statistically significant basis. Now, what does that suggest? We can then turn to, now, we did tell South Australia is a caveat to all of this, that curriculum does not constitute equity. That curriculum sits within a large funding, school support, all of the other educational policies, and that sits within all of the community policies, the family policies, etc., and that sits within, obviously, a larger political economy. So curriculum doesn't cause equity or inequity. It sits within a set of nested relationships within educational policy, social and economic policy, and then a larger political economic context. And obviously, the Nordic countries and Canada have different taxation structures and a different ethos and commitment around equity. So we can't assume curriculum causes equity or doesn't cause equity. It sits within a nested set of social relations. And it's worth looking at the work of ANU economist Fred Argy on a continuum of political economies. And what Argy argues is that the Howard government has progressively moved Australia towards the right in this country. Towards model one in Argy is a libertarian model like the U.S., an open market model. And model four, according to Argy, on a 1-4 continuum of political economies, is the Nordic model, which is an egalitarian, an economy that's committed to social infrastructure, as against the rollback of the welfare state and so forth. And what Argy begins to argue is that in the last 10 years, you would know the argument, Australia has progressively been pushed by this government down towards the U.S. model. So that's the political economic context. And obviously, but the interesting anomaly in this probably is Canada, which has also moved down marketization routes, but whose whose equity results on PISA don't appear to nearly create as many problems or evidence as much of an achievement gap problem as Australia. Now, looking at this data, before I'll comment briefly on Finland and Ontario, but before I get to that, I suggest that you look very closely at not just the work of Richard Teese at Melbourne, but also the reanalysis by Margaret Vickers and Stephen Lamb of the impacts. They took the impacts of different state pathway structures on or senior schooling structures on results, on overall equity. And the argument that Vickers and Lamb make, I think it was published in the Australian Journal of Ed, but I can send Kim or Paul the reference. The argument that Vickers and Lamb make is that the more open the pathways and flexible the pathway structures from middle years into senior schools, has very little effect upon the top-achieving kids. They appear to do well no matter what system you put them in. Heavily structured we could create a continuum probably with Queensland somewhere here and Victoria's pathway experiments here and the new SACE revisions in South Australia here moving towards open pathways, and I'll talk about some of the characteristics of those there, and probably the New South Wales system being among the most rigid. What they begin to argue, and they use the term wastage rate, is that in the more strict traditional academic VOC pathways, binary pathway systems, which are choke-pointed with an HSC or high-scale exam system, that there's a higher wastage rate for lower SES kids and kids in the bottom quartile. Is that, everybody got the rough argument? So contrary to some of the papers and discussion that's gone on, I think, well, I was away at least in the last 2 to 3 years here, Vickers and Lamb make the case that the Queensland-type system, as it might materialize in ETRF, et cetera, will have differential equity effects. That the use of the moderation system as against a high-stakes exam system will have equity effects because it will differentially impact upon the wastage rate. Is that so? I'll send you the Vickers and Lamb paper, which will I think make that case. And the papers that I'm citing are not qualitative case; they're reanalysis of PISA data and exit data and retention rate data. Okay, now. If Finland and Ontario do seem to make a difference and seem to, if the Nordic countries more generally, and we take Norway out of the mix because Norway's gone down market reforms, and the interesting thing is Norway 5-7 years ago began to move down outcomes-based, more heavily specified and more test-driven systems, and the result in the last 5 years has been their equity problem seems to have gotten much greater as a result of going towards a more standardized system. The other thing that I'll just put aside and say that the low quality, low equity system, the star is probably Germany. Okay, and as David might have informed you today, some of the Singapore data shows us that early streaming does have equity effects. Okay. It does lock in the social class disparity very early on. So I'll just put that as an aside because it takes up a big section of the PISA reports, and I think we've got a lot of data. And Jeannie Oakes has done a lot of work in the U.S. that if we move towards an earlier streaming, an earlier formal streaming or de facto streaming system, that it will lock in the social class disadvantage. We've known that in the literature for quite a few years. But let's go back to what Finland and Ontario do differently, okay? First of all, the Finnish system, as I mentioned, is very low definition. The curriculum documents identify things that are about essential educational experiences and thereabouts. I'd say that the average course document is maybe 10 to 15 pages, and the entire year one curriculum is about 10 to 15 pages. It then goes to municipal work program development at the municipal level, which would be a de facto cluster level. And then it goes down to the school level development. In both the Canadian and the Nordic systems, what we begin to see is one of the characteristics of high quality, high equity systems is a strong emphasis on teacher professionalism and a strong emphasis on local curriculum development, such as we do in Queensland with the senior syllabus work programs, okay? As against a high level of specification. Other systems might have uniform textbook set, everybody reading the same textbook at the same time, and so forth. Okay? So the system that was built in Queensland has some similar characteristics to the Nordic systems and the Canadian systems in that it gives teachers the play at the local level to exercise their professionalism depending upon their clientele. Okay, is that... So high degrees of professionalism. And what we can begin to see, and I want to develop this work in the next year, is a relationship between heavier degrees of curriculum specification, or to use McLuhan's terms, high-definition curriculum yielding low professionalism, and low-definition curriculum placing the onus upon professional interpretation at the level of the school. And the high-equity, high-quality systems have low specification and high levels of professionalism, also heavy levels of investment in professional development and so forth. Okay, everybody got the rough argument? Now, that argument, I think, you'd find is corroborated with... In some of the PISA data, but also I think that you need to see that the argument that's being run here with more testing, more explicit scripting, more curriculum specification, that Michael Apple's argument in 1978 does hold, that it does de-skill teachers, and the de-skilling does have equity effects. Okay. In those countries, especially when we look at Canada and the Nordics. Now, the other thing that that Canada and the Nordics do is they also begin life counseling. In Canada, it's done through teacher advisors in the state of in Ontario and British Columbia, but in Ontario particularly, they begin counseling about year seven. No high stakes decision is made about which pathway to take, but it's not career counseling in the classic sense. But it's individual program decisions and so forth. And in the Ontario system, they've brought in a digital portfolio that is a full transcript that records all of the students' achievements of different kinds, academic and non-academic, that will follow the child from year seven all the way through. And I think Canada also has, I think in favor, almost similar to what Bishop has proposed, a very parsimonious set of statements that run across all subjects in all years, on an A through E or something like that in the system, with some very, very simple standards, okay, that run across all curriculum, not separate standard statements for every course or subject, but actually a template that runs across all curriculum. So what also do we find? Furthermore, the other point that I'd make is there in the Ontario system, so what have I said here? Let me go back. High professionalism, low definition curriculum, okay? Second thing, early life pathway planning, starting as in the seventh year of schooling in Ontario and in the Nordics, okay? And then accompanying that pathway planning, a systematic tracking or portfolio system that doesn't just have academic stuff but has other stuff on the kid as well. And I'll come back to that in relationship to the Edmund Rice work on portfolios that we're doing, okay? The curriculum in the Nordic countries is fairly straightforward. I think 8 KLAs, roughly thereabouts. But from I've got it in the paper. I think from about year 9 on, the kids begin to assemble courses of study out of different subjects. Okay, and where SACE is going in South Australia, and where the Ontario system has gone towards to achieve flexible pathways, is almost a university-type system of credits, where the kid has to achieve this many credits between years 10, 11, and 12 with a core of mandatory subjects identified and electives, vocational, non-vocational, non-academic, mixed and matched. And in Ontario, interestingly enough, it'll introduce psychology, anthropology, etc. So you're preparing kids for almost a junior college kind of set of selections. And I think what's happened in the Ontario system and in the Nordic systems is that kids can proceed at any pace at which they want. Half-time, full-time, with repeats. The Canadian system has summer school, it has online delivery, and it has cross-crediting and transfer between schools. So you can take subjects at different schools. So when we talk flexible pathways here in the Nordics and in Ontario, we're actually talking about optimal flexibility, okay, in which kids can mix and match a heritage language that they didn't get. The other thing that both the Nordics and the Canadians do is language is one of the core that's required, okay, a second language of some kind, second language study. But If you looked at them, you'd find the Nordics stick more or less with the 8 KLAs and try to configure them around that. The Canadians actually augmented and opened it out into some very high interest areas like psychology, anthropology, and specialized social sciences and others. Okay? So what we begin to see is professionalism, early counseling, systematic portfolio tracking, and then a truly flexible system towards, get this, very few credentials, a limited number of credentials, hence the parity of esteem argument. Okay, so I think one of the mistakes that we could make is proliferating a zillion credentials here. In Ontario, in the Nordic systems, there's usually a single senior certificate, which in some countries can be subscripted, in others not, but a single certificate. And in Ontario, I think there are two certificates. Okay? But what that allows is a fair mixing and matching. Now, what does that mean? It means that these countries have pretty much allow the portfolio, the transcript, and the record to speak more than they would let a single numerator speak of any kind. Okay? So parity of outcomes, parity of credentials, but multiple and flexible pathways to get to those credentials. Some academic, some less academic, some mixed and matched. Okay. The final element of these systems that we've picked up is very, very low, very, very little, if any, high stakes testing. Okay. Sample testing, and in fact, it's interesting because in the Finnish system, you can elect to join the national testing system if you have a specific problem or if you're in a school renewal cycle. You can elect to opt in, okay, but it's not mandatory. The Ontario system does use some census testing, but in all of these systems we see high levels of diagnostic and formative assessment at the school level and at the classroom level, as against high stakes testing. Okay? All right. Now that summarizes, I think, what we found the characteristics of the high equity, high quality systems were. Professionalism, counseling, flexible pathways towards credentials with parity of esteem, and not a lot of high stakes assessment, and a little if any streaming of any sort at all. Okay, let me turn to the work that we're doing with at Centrelink, Edmund Rice. Dale Murray, as you know, has been taking in street kids in the Logan Beanley area for many years. This may not seem relevant to you because you're talking about the senior curriculum, but I think it'll point to you to some of the focal issues around assessment that we've got in schools. When these kids are brought in, some of them will take basic reading and writing. I visited a lot. They're doing a lot with music production, with art. Will Davis runs an Indigenous program out in Logan Beanley, and now five other centers have been set up in Ipswich, Townsville, etc. They're drop-in places for the kids that Education Queensland, the fish that John West doesn't want or that John West won't take, okay? And they get quite remarkable results. They approached us with the brief of wanting to, because their sponsors, who include Education Queensland, the DEST, but as well Brisbane City Council and a number of philanthropic organizations, will want to see bang for their buck in quantitative terms. They'll want to see some kind of demonstration of value adding other than the Edmund Rice telling these kids that their spiritual capital has been increased or something like that by participating in the programs. Typically, when we look at the way that the assessment traditions that are available to us, we have a traditional curriculum content examination system, which, thanks to these our colleagues here, we don't use in Queensland, but probably was invented by the Chinese. I figured that out. I was told that in Japan yesterday. So we have a curriculum content. We have a curriculum content tradition, but the other two traditions that we have for assessing street kids and others are the Thorndike psychometric tradition, that is a behaviorist basic skills tradition of standardized norm reference achievement test, which is about 100 years old and is very good for testing automaticity of basic skills, but not much else, okay? And the third tradition, I think, that we have emergent for these kids is a psychopathological tradition that emerges from the last 20 years looking at suicide, risk, depression, that is there to catch at-risk youth, okay? What Edmund Rice said was, well, we know we're doing a damn good job with these kids. They're off the street. Some of them are off drugs. Some of them are actually enrolling in TAFE certificates, etc. But how do we get an assessment portfolio system that actually doesn't find them at deficit from point one. So we began fiddling with the notions from Pierre Bourdieu and others that kids come to school with different kinds of baskets of resources and capital, and that we needed to put together, like Ontario, a transcript or portfolio system that actually didn't just assess kids' credentials, their institutional capital, and didn't just, but also included their material capital, their artwork, their rap music, their videos, their writings, and also included an assessment of, obviously, their traditional test scores in which we could portfolio all these things together. But we also wanted to assess their symbolic capital, that is, their community service, the rise in their friendship levels, okay, in their friendship groups, in which they could begin to talk about the other acquisitions. And one of the and then Edmund Rice came in and said, "Can you test their spiritual capital too?" And so we're going to subcontract that, you know. The point that I want to make is this: the national goals of schooling, all of the OECD goals, all of our systems goals, particularly post 9/11, talk about learning to live together, as the Dolores report. They talk about social competences. They talk about friendship networks. They talk about wanting to build people that have something other than phonics, okay, or their chem tables, able to be reproduced on a test. But yet the assessment and evaluation business, from Iowa testing right to ETS, is pretty much operating in a paradigm that was developed for industrial skills 100 years ago. David Hogan and I used to have long debates about this in Singapore, because all of the things that in the literature we referred to, all of the things that weren't testable either by traditional examination content tests or by standardized norm reference behavioral skill tests, we referred to them as, we used to find, non-cognitive skills. Now that's the Cartesian dualism. That's like when I remember when I was working at UQ, it was often somebody in a budget meeting once referred to education as a non-engineering faculty. You know, and I thought, that's a default mode if I ever heard one, okay? So we've got the non-cognitive, the non-engineering, and the interesting thing is, we want these things to count. And teachers unions, people, the chalk face, consistently tell us, these are the things that are important, that we're getting gains on. But we've been strapped, and I remember Paul Leach convened a Makicha working party many years ago to look at how we could put them on the map without micronizing them and turning them into another test score battery. And I think the Ontario approach is probably the way to go, which is a digital portfolio that captures a range of artifactual, social interactional, other kinds of outcomes other than the purely. Now, it's interesting because you might remember, you've heard of Tom Cruise? You might remember watching Risky Business, because at the onset of Risky Business, the first... Remember that was, he went out with Rebecca De Mornay and trashed the parents' house that night? That was the night before his set-up interview with Harvard or something like that, or Yale. And the privates in the U.S. for years have admitted by portfolios. Is that? By rich portfolios of work that include service, sports, awards, letters of reference, and an artifact, usually writing samples and so forth, okay? I think that we've been drawn into doing the business of universities and saving them a tremendous amount of money. And as Tease would argue, sucked into that business and then therefore setting up a cognitive architecture of curriculum subjects and hierarchies that has extreme deleterious equity effects. Okay? And I think Tease and Vickers and Lamb will show that. So that's pretty much what I'm doing, and that's pretty much, there's some of the considerations. South Australia paper should be out in as I said, as soon as if their government releases it, we're going to submit the final to them in 2 weeks, but we have it in draft now. Okay, thanks, Kim.